The last time we discussed the German election on this podcast, our two guests were unanimous. Social democracy was heading for defeat, maybe even third place. But a couple of months is a very long time in politics these days.
Germany's center-left Social Democrats have narrowly claimed victory in the country's federal election.
Olaf Scholz, career politician, finance minister and former mayor of Hamburg, is not yet Germany's chancellor, but few are betting against him.
The CDU-CSU, that center-right bloc that's been in power for almost the last 16 years under Angela Merkel, they lost more than 1.5 million votes to the center-left.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper. Our guest today is Jeremy Cliff, the international editor at the New Statesman. Based in Berlin, he's been keeping an eagle eye on the German political situation for some time. In fact, he was one of the few people who was reluctant to entirely discount the possibility of the social democratic surge. So I'll be asking him what his prophecies are for the coalition talks ahead. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
Welcome to the show, Jeremy. Great to have you on.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
And we did a podcast not so long ago, back in the summer. I think we invited you to be on it, but you couldn't make it, actually. And we ended up having one guest from the left and one from the Social Democrats. And I think this was in June sometime. Podcast listeners can find it in the back catalogue. They were both of the view that social democracy was basically out of the running and didn't have a hope of becoming chancellor. They've now won the election. What happened?
Yeah, I think a lot of people were surprised by what happened over the last, what was it, 4 or 5 weeks of the campaign only, when the SPD sort of roared from third place behind the Greens and the Christian Democrats into first place. But I think there were some signs earlier on, and I at least knew a couple of Social Democrats here in Berlin who were saying, we think that Olaf Scholz can pull this off against the odds, you know, as early as this spring. But it took a certain leap of faith to to claim that. But I think there were a few fundamentals in their favour. Obviously, first of all, the departure of Angela Merkel. And I think maybe a lot of German voters only started to register that reality as election day started to bear down on them and look at who the Christian Democrats were putting up, namely Armin Laschet, who was a very weak and gaffe-prone candidate. That, of course, is another factor in this. You know, we hadn't necessarily reckoned on how poorly he would perform. You know, he made various, most prominently, he was caught laughing in the background when Germany's president was giving a somber speech about the flooding in July. But there were a number of other gaffes as well, and his performance in the TV debates was at points punchy, but not terribly authoritative. So first of all, Olaf Scholz and the SPD were lucky in their opponent. That applies to some extent for the Greens as well, actually. There was a point in about May when the Greens actually overtook even the Christian Democrats into first place. But, I mean, Annalena Baerbock, the chancellor candidate, I actually think she gets a bit of a tough press. You know, she did still deliver their best ever election result, just under 15%. That's up about 6 points on last time. So it was hardly a disaster. But it did fall short a bit of expectations. And she did get tangled up in some avoidable mistake details on her CV that hadn't been properly checked. It seems to happen a lot to German politicians, but there was something she'd written where there were claims of plagiarism or having not properly referenced or credited a source. Easy avoidable stuff that could have been sorted out, you know, by the campaign. And she fell foul of that and I think struggled to recover. So they were lucky in their opponents. They were lucky that Merkel was going. So voters were sort of starting to look and ask, you know, what's the alternative?
As a follower of German politics and Austrian politics, and as an academic, I do find the cultural difference between the UK and the Germanic countries on one's academic qualifications to be quite something. I felt very sorry for Barbuk during the campaign when her master's from the LSE was questioned as sufficiently robust and things. I was like, you could never imagine this happening to a British politician. If anything, having academic qualifications is a disadvantage in the British political culture, right? It's really just a completely different world.
It's seen as pretty important here. And you get, I don't think this is true of Baerbock, but you get the sense in some cases that politicians, or, you know, young, politically ambitious people do doctorates on the side while they're climbing the slippery pole politically, that probably wouldn't be doing them if they didn't think it was necessary for their political career. And I do wonder if some of these cases of corners being cut, or, you know, in some cases, obvious outright plagiarism, might have something to do with that. But that's another discussion.
Oh, that is interesting. And it is another discussion. So was this a personal defeat for Laschet, do you think? Or does it tell us something about a structural crisis in the CDU? I mean, this is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek remark, but, you know, if they were a centre-left party, we'd probably be reading New Statesman columns about PASOKification, surely, in light of this result, the experience of the Greek social democracy that invented that very ugly term and when they completely collapsed. Are the Christian Democrats in real long-term structural trouble now with the electorate?
Well, hands up, I have, in the past, used the phrase PASOKification. I tried to avoid that, particularly in the last years, as I think, first of all, the experience of PASOK in Greece was so extreme and the situation there overall was so extreme that it's probably not a helpful comparison. But also for the reason that you raised, which is that in many ways, the crisis of social democracy, if we can call it that, is actually a broader story about fragmentation, you know, and big block parties. They're called Volksparteien in Germany, so people's parties, also, I think, in Austria. And that refers to these big tent parties that were seen as synthesizing differences, or kind of, you know, containing differences within society and occupying a big swathe of the political center. And those parties particularly have suffered, both on the center left and the center right. You know, you look at the state of Christian democracy, well, or Gaullism, I suppose, in France. You look at the state of traditional Christian democracy in Italy. I mean, that collapsed in the early 1990s. And you look at the Christian Democrats in the Netherlands. They're a, you know, husk of their former selves. So it's not just in Germany where, first of all, where social democrats are struggling because they're struggling elsewhere, but also where Christian democrats are struggling. And I actually wonder whether, you know, two things might have kept the Christian democratic voter base together in Germany for longer than it endured elsewhere. I think the fact of Angela Merkel, a sort of popular leader, and whatever you think of her record as chancellor, a skilled politician, combined with the fact that the German economy has been in a fortunate place for much of the last 15 years, you know, it's benefited from China's economic rise. Economic growth has been stronger here than elsewhere, you know, in the period where she's been chancellor. People's sense of their own material well-being is relatively good compared with other European countries. So I just wonder if all of those forces sort of held that Christian democratic base together. But of course, now Merkel's gone and it's disintegrating, probably as it always was going to some extent, but just a little bit later.
I don't know what your view on this is, but, you know, one complaint that we often hear, I suppose, especially from the German left, is that really German politics is kind of a centrism producing machine. And if you were looking for big policy differences between the Greens, the CDU and the SPD in this election, you probably wouldn't find them. Is that a fair description? Or what were the big, if any, the big debates between the parties? Climate change must have been a huge factor after the floods, for instance.
Exactly. I think there is a broader consensus in German politics around some big picture stuff, certainly compared to, you know, the UK, where the last election was Boris Johnson versus Jeremy Corbyn, or the US, or US politics, which is of course so polarized. And naturally that's partly a product of the electoral system. It's not a majoritarian one, it's a proportional one that rewards those who can forge alliances and find common ground, as we're going to be seeing over the next weeks with the coalition talks. But I do think that was sometimes exaggerated. Oh, they're all the same. There's no difference between the four broadly mainstream parties, the Christian Democrats, Social Democrats, Liberals and Greens. There were and are big differences. And I think it's just a bit glib to say, oh, they're all the same. And you could see that on a lot of points. For example, you know, independent studies of the projected distributional impact of the policies of the different parties' manifestos, drastically different. You know, the CDU and CSU put forward essentially regressive manifestos that would disproportionately benefit the best off. The SPD and the Greens, quite a different story, disproportionately benefiting the lowest off and actually putting more of the burden of paying for services and so forth on the wealthiest. So I don't buy the idea there was no difference. And then, as you say, climate change in particular sort of stands out as an example of that. The Greens want to shut down the last coal station by 2030. The other mainstream parties want to stick to a goal of 2038. That's an enormous difference when you think of the size of the project they're talking about there. And even in terms of kind of overall climate targets, I mean, I was looking at this with regards to the coalition talks recently, but, you know, of the three parties that might form a so-called traffic light government, which looks like the most likely, so the Social Democrats, the Greens and the Free Democrats, who by the way, are referred to often as liberals, although I prefer the term conservative liberals because I think they are sort of on the right of the liberal family. And there's a huge variance there. You know, I think the FDP manifesto envisages 11 gigatons a year of carbon dioxide as a target. For the SPD, it's 7 gigatons, and for the Greens, it's 5 gigatons. There's an enormous order of magnitude size difference in their climate goals. So yes, there are big differences.
On industrial policy, you mentioned how Germany as an economy had benefited from China's rise. Hasn't the CDU really, in alliance with the SPD, developed what would in most countries be considered quite a left policy? So investing in German industry, very pro-state aid, very pro-building sort of a strong social contract economy. And I suppose in some countries, when we talk about a dominator at the centre ground dominating, we would probably mean that in a very neoliberal way, but it's not quite the case in Germany. And, you know, furthermore, I remember after the last elections in 2017, talking to an Austrian friend who was living in Germany about this amazing child paternity leave that he was about to benefit from, that in the 2017 election had been Merkel's big offer. So he was on a temporary contract, and a month before his contract ran up, he was just going to tell his employer, oh yeah, I've got a baby, here are the details, and he would get a year's paid paternity leave. And so really amazing, certainly by British standards, but also internationally, it's just not something you would necessarily expect a Christian Democratic Party to back and support. Was there a kind of crisis of ideas for the Christian democracy this time? Because it seemed a lot of the time that Laschet was basically doing quite a sort of Boris Johnson Trump thing, even saying the danger of the Linkspartei and the social democracy going into bed with the extreme left. That's the big issue in this election. And it seemed to suggest that they'd run out of road in terms of big policy ideas.
Absolutely. And I mean, that there were some notable social democratic achievements in the Merkel years, overwhelmingly, it must be said, driven by social democratic ministers rather than Merkel herself. And I think this is one of the reasons why she comes out of this, you know, for a chancellorship with, I think, a genuinely mixed record, with this reputation as a sort of progressive hero. It's partly, certainly domestic policy is concerned, because she let SPD ministers get on with delivering their manifesto pledges. So that was the case with the paternity leave, which is generous, especially by comparison to Britain. I benefited from that myself too. You also have a right to a childcare place here, and you can sue the state government if you don't get one. It's essentially free. Germany introduced a minimum wage in 2015. That was another sort of progressive achievement, again driven by the SPD. Yeah, and I think, you know, the Christian Democratic model under Merkel was to appropriate those policies from parties of the centre-left. They also appropriated some green policies, by the way, for example, switching off the nuclear power stations, while kind of having a figurehead in Merkel who was very reassuring and could keep the Christian Democratic coalition together broadly, although it did, you know, their vote share did decline. And of course, now she's gone, that's now open, you know, you're left with a Christian Democratic party that doesn't have many ideas of its own. I mean, I was talking to Georg Diaz, who's a kind of essayist here in Germany, for the profile of Merkel I wrote, and he said that essentially the Christian Democrats are at least 10 years behind where they need to be in terms of ideas for Germany in the 2020s. Intellectually, it's a pretty moribund party family. and they're going to have to, you know, do something about that. And of course, whether they end up sort of, you know, trying to modernize the Merkel model, if they end up in opposition, which looks fairly likely, or swing to the right, which is another option, is an open question. But yes, they have been left, you know, it's almost like the tide's gone out and they're left without the thing that kept them in power, which was Merkel and the approach she personified. By the way, I mean, I mentioned earlier that the SPD wasn't just lucky in its opponents in this election. It did get some things right. And I think that one of those things was it had a chancellor candidate in Olaf Scholz who personified many of the characteristics that made Merkel popular, particularly among older voters. Both of their parties now have a disproportionately old voter base, you know, while combining it with some pretty classic social democratic policy proposals. So a higher minimum wage, more house building, stable pensions. He was well placed to inherit her mantle.
Brexit has happened, and many of the things we warned about are coming true, but no one seems to want to talk about it. Here at Another Europe, we say it's time for meaningful accountability and real scrutiny, and that's where our new project, Brexit Spotlight, comes in. We're breaking the silence and shining a light on the calamities. Find out more at brexitspotlight.org. Let's talk about some of the constituency level results that look quite interesting. There's a big shift in the former East Germany, it looks like, from the left to the SPD. In general, there were some very welcome losses for the far right overall, I think, but they are very strong in some local areas like Saxony, where they were the biggest party. What do you make of it, of the kind of geography of the vote in the new Germany? Because there was a map floating around Twitter that showed the constituency results at the last election, and it was basically the CDU winning at a constituency level, being the largest party in most places, but it's now covered with red. That looks fairly significant, notwithstanding being the largest party means you only have 25% of the vote.
It does. The map can be misleading because, of course, constituencies only correspond to 299 seats in the Bundestag. The next Bundestag will be 735 seats. So the majority, and indeed the balance between the parties, is decided by people's list vote. So it's a bit like Scotland. You have two votes and only one of them decides the overall makeup of the parliament. But yeah, it is. You do get an interesting story from the map. You know, it's clear that you can see from that the way that the SPD has sort of swept a lot of particularly kind of rural and suburban areas of northern Germany on both sides of the old divide. The CDU also lost votes to the SPD in the former East. You're also seeing, by the way, the Greens start to win more constituencies outright. So they always did very well on that second vote, you know, thanks to list votes. But they're now winning well. They're doing well enough in certain constituencies to take those. So, you know, they used to hold just one seat, which is actually the one I happen to be in now, in central Berlin, Friedrichshain, Kreuzberg, Prenzlauer Berg East. But they've now picked up Freiburg, for example, in the southwest. They picked up Munich south. They picked up Flensburg in the far north. So there's that. As for the AfD, that's actually, I think, where looking at the constituency map can be a little bit distorting. They have done particularly well in Saxony. That has long been a stronghold of theirs. By the way, for those who don't know, that Saxony is the southernmost state in the former East. So it's kind of right up against the border with the Czech Republic and Poland. So that they have long had strengths there. But I think that what's worth stressing is that they generally still do well, or relatively well, across the whole former East. It's just that in Saxony, well, they do a little bit stronger in Saxony than elsewhere, but the rest of the party landscape there is particularly fragmented. So you don't have a strong CDU or a strong SPD as you do in some other, or indeed a strong left party as you do in some other parts of the East. And so they win constituencies on quite a low share of the vote. So I think overall in Saxony, they won just under 25% of the votes. It wasn't that different in the other former Eastern states, but some of those have stronger or more consolidated non-AfD party landscape. So for example, Mecklenburg, Western Pomerania, which is the northernmost of the former Eastern states, so on the Baltic coast, you know, there you have a very strong SPD and a popular state minister president from the SPD. And so even though the AfD still did quite well there, I think they got something like 18 or 19%, you don't see it because the SPD does well enough to kind of sweep the board when it comes to the constituencies. So yes, we're seeing that the AfD very much is a party of the former East. It very much does draw on elements of this sort of disaffection there, particularly among older voters, particularly among male voters. But it is a slightly more spread out picture than the constituency map would suggest.
It might come as a shock to UK listeners. Quite a few of our listeners are overseas, actually, so we're not just a UK-based pod. But the coalition negotiations in London would take a weekend, and then they would be over and you would have a government. That's completely not the culture in Germany, or indeed many other European countries, where they can often take really quite a long time. So what's your take on these coalition negotiations? There's obviously two big parties that are the kingmakers here, the Greens and the Free Democrats that you mentioned earlier. Looking at those two parties, they don't really have much in common. One, as you say, is on the centre-right, and one is really more orientated to centre-left, pro-investment, pro-EU reform and this kind of thing. They are now having a negotiation amongst themselves initially to try to formulate a common platform, is that right, before they go into negotiations with the two other potential partners in this coalition, Social Democrats, who could be Chancellor, or the Christian Democrats? Can you talk us through this process?
Sure. I mean, it's important to know that the experience in 2017 after the last election haunts the coalition talks this time around, because it looked after the last election like it would be a shoo-in Jamaica coalition. So that's a coalition of the Christian Democrats, the Greens, and the Free Democrats. And they went into these coalition talks, but various things went wrong. There was a sense that, first of all, the Free Democrats were sidelined. There was a sense that too much of it was playing out essentially in public or was leaking, you know, during the talks. And it all ended with the Free Democrats walking out of the talks entirely, which is why Germany ended up with yet another grand coalition with the Christian and Social Democrats. So this time around, they're trying to do it differently. Both the Free Democrats really have to get into government this time. It was a big gamble by Christian Lindner, the party's leader, to walk out last time. If he doesn't get his party into government this time around, I think he's toast. The Greens, too, are impatient to govern. And so what they're going to do, particularly now that, you know, given that whether they govern with the Social Democrats or the Christian Democrats, they will have a very weak leading partner in that coalition. They want to use their joint leverage wisely. And I think it's very clever to say that they talk together first, partly because, as you say, they are quite far apart on some of the big issues. So the logic is, if they can come to agreements, then not only can they negotiate with a stronger hand with the larger party, whichever it is, or both for a while, but they can also... that actually moves the whole process forward, because, you know, if they can agree, then it's actually probably quite easy for whatever their compromise positions are to be squared with either the Christian or the Social Democrats. As for the differences and similarities between those two, you know, in many ways, that's the big question. If they can come together, then, you know, then either a Jamaica or a traffic light government looks pretty doable. It's worth pointing out that there are some underestimated similarities between the two parties. Yes, they are far apart on the economy and on climate change, but they both represent a fairly similar social milieu. You know, they're the two parties with the most, on average, the highest educated voters, on average, the youngest voters, on average, the most high earning voters, on average, the most urban voters. And so often they represent, as someone put it to me the other day, kind of two sides of the same street, or the different sides of the same street. A similar social milieu with a different ideological outlook. And they both set themselves up as modernizing parties, as parties of change, in contrast with those Volkspartei and the Christian and Social Democrats. They both have quite a sort of youthful, dynamic, web-savvy leadership. And we saw that the other day when the two leading negotiators from the Free Democrats and the two co-leaders of the Greens Instagrammed out a selfie in which they, after a first informal meeting in which they were talking about how well they were getting on. And they do have certain similarities on social policy. You know, they're both socially libertarian. So they're both, you know, both parties are for legalizing cannabis, lowering the voting age to 16, they agree on some civil liberties stuff. So oversight of intelligence agencies, They want to also, for example, want to make it legal to for those who provide abortion services to advertise that. It's currently not allowed in Germany. But the big differences are obviously economic policy. But even there too, it looks like there might be some ways of reconciling their differences. And a big one is the Greens want a lot of public investment in decarbonizing the economy, whereas the FDP thinks that they don't deny climate change. In fact, they talk about it quite a lot, but they think that the response to it has to be market-led and business-led. And the common ground seems to be the FDP are also neurotic about sort of fiscal irresponsibility as they see it, and very wedded to Germany's constitutional debt brake, which limits deficit spending. The common ground seems to be you have an off-balance sheet investment fund or wealth fund of some sort that doesn't defy the debt brake, but that allows for substantial investment in green infrastructure. And there are other areas where you can sort of start to square the differences, including how you do carbon pricing, how you know, there's a suggestion that the Greens might give up their proposal for a wealth tax in return for more inheritance taxation. And, you know, once you start looking at those sorts of ideas, it does look that there might be a way through.
Yeah, that potential compromise, I saw you talking about to Adam Tooth about it on Twitter, actually. Yeah. I was under the impression that in Germany, investment spending was already considered separate from day-to-day government spending. Is that not quite right? Have I got that wrong?
It is, but it is still constrained by the debt brake.
Right, okay.
So there is a school of thought that says you have to get rid of the debt brake completely, that it is such a constraint in terms of the restrictions it puts on the federal government. And of course, don't forget state governments, who are in many ways more crucial because they deliver a lot of this sort of infrastructure, you know, make the debt brake in itself the problem. But then you have, I think, and that might be possible in the medium to long term, but it's just not an option in the short term, because you'd need a two-thirds majority in both the lower and the upper house to push that through. But so the interesting debate, particularly on the progressive side of politics recently, has been what can you do within the debt brake? And one of the things you can do is set up these special purpose vehicles that kind of hold assets and therefore don't count against the calculation of the overall deficit. But we'll see exactly what comes out of the talks. Obviously, it's kind of slightly open question how this works, who oversees it, how much firepower it is. That's the other question, because there are some who say yes, of course they can do something like that, but how big would it actually be compared to the scale of the task? And as mentioned earlier, you know, the Greens and the FDP do see, you know, have very different overall climate goals, and, you know, where they come down, you know, between those two is not really very clear so far.
I liked the way you represented the difference between the Greens and the Free Democrats as basically two sides of the table at your average Frankfurt under 30s dinner party.
Yes, exactly.
So I suppose is the ultimate reason why these coalition talks will take so long is that really they go into a lot of granular policy detail. So the scope of what the government is going to do for the next 4 years is basically going to be decided over the next 3 months. Is that right?
That is right. I mean, when, you know, you look back to the formation of the coalition in the UK in 2010, the way it was done, I think it was 4 days. I mean, that's, Britain is less familiar with coalitions. It has a different relationship with that sort of politics. The assumption here is,
or even more recently in Scotland, though.
You know, true,
the Greens,
good point.
And the SNP, you know,
in an electoral system that's very similar to that works basically as Germany's does. That's a very good point. The assumption here is that coalition deals are very detailed. The last one in 2017 was 175 pages. That wasn't particularly unusual. There is, every so often, there are suggestions that coalition agreements should be a bit looser and should be a bit less detailed. Christian Lindner of the Free Democrats has talked about, as he calls it, a lighthouse deal, which is sort of, it shows the way, but it doesn't tell you exactly, you know, it doesn't go into great detail. It sets some broad parameters. But I think the assumption here is that it would, you know, we're going to get a deal, you know, closer to Germany's 2017 deal than the sort of one we saw, you know, we've seen in UK politics. As for how long it will take, when the results came in and it was clear that there were several possible governments, that the two biggest parties were relatively close together, everyone sort of rolled their eyes and said, "Oh no, we're not going to have a government until the spring." But I think increasingly, as the Christian Democrats turn in on themselves, as they are doing as we record this, and as Armin Laschet's chances of chancellor shrink yet further, albeit they're not completely vanished, the possibility that the traffic light parties are able to square a deal relatively quickly by German standards seems to be rising. And the kind of the smart money, or at least the smart people, seem to be saying that, you know, a deal by Christmas is possible. And I think that partly also comes from the fact that you've got the Greens and the FDP talking already. Because if they can, as I said previously, if they can reconcile their differences and find common ground, that gets an overall coalition, you know, say a traffic light led by the SPD, a long way down the road to being negotiated. Obviously, that, you know, the Social Democrats need to come in, and they're going to start talking together this weekend. They have their own priorities, but it's a very positive sign that it can work.
Great. And maybe this should have been the first question, given the title of the podcast, We're for Another Europe. What does all this mean for Eurozone reform, obviously, or the future of the European Union more broadly? I mean, obviously, Germany, clearly the most powerful economy, arguably the most powerful state geopolitically in the European Union, especially after Brexit. Is there just a consensus amongst these parties that they're pro-European, or will the Free Democrats look at Eurozone reform and say, well, so far, but no further, thanks, and we don't want a permanent sort of pro-free spending Eurozone. We want to keep it under wraps.
Yeah, there is a relatively broad consensus on Europe among the mainstream parties here in Germany. They all proclaim themselves to be pro-European. They all say they want further integration of the European Union. So that's one of these subjects where, compared to the UK, the debate seems very consolidated and the difference quite small. But on the details, there are differences. You know, the FDP and the CDU, for example, are most enthusiastic about defence integration and kind of common European defence projects. The Greens, to some extent, albeit with kind of constrained by a kind of cultural pacifism. The SPD is more divided on that. And then on the crucial question of sort of, you know, Eurozone fiscal policy and economics in the EU more widely, there are big differences. So, you know, famously Macron said in 2017, if the FDP get into government, I'll be dead, because he'd just been elected French president, had this big, the famous Sorbonne agenda, particularly pushing Eurozone integration, banking union, kind of completing the project of economic integration in some ways. And the FDP are famously skeptical about that. And they rail against the transfer union, as they call it, or a debt union, anything that basically means shackling German taxpayers, particularly prosperous urban taxpayers that tend to vote FDP, with the debts and the allegedly lacking economic competitiveness of other parts of the EU, particularly the South. So on that, you know, the Free Democrats are much closer to the famous Frugal Four, the sort of the northern, you know, the smaller northern states who've acted as a bloc on a lot of these proposals. It's worth saying that Olaf Scholz of the SPD is not exactly a kind of flaming Macronist either on this. You know, he has a reputation for fiscal caution, but I think he's more open to the conversation than they are. And as finance minister under Merkel, you know, he was important in pushing through the Next Generation EU fund, the COVID recovery fund. He worked very closely with Bruno Le Maire, the French finance minister, on that. He has been open to advancing banking union and common deposit insurance as finance minister, which sound like quite wonky technocratic themes, but are actually fundamental to a kind of balanced Eurozone with a chance of, you know, with a chance of lifting its weaker economies as well as its stronger ones. It's worth saying that the Greens are like the SPD, more open to those conversations too. In fact, if anything, even more so. How a traffic light government would act on that, particularly with Christian Lindner of the Free Democrats in the finance ministry, which seems to be the way things are going, is open to debate. I think it would certainly be better for the kind of reform agenda than a Jamaica government, in which you'd have two parties of the centre-right rather than just one. But I think that anyone expecting a kind of radical conversion of the kind of German government to Paris thinking on a lot of this stuff will be disappointed. But I do think you might get a bit more openness, including from the Chancellery, which, as we've seen under Merkel, is crucial. A lot of policy is run directly from the Chancellery, particularly when it comes to Europe, and particularly in the heat of a crisis, which, as we know, is often when these changes actually get made. And, you know, it's also pointed out that, yes, the FDP are difficult on these subjects, but they are technically members of Macron's own political family. They are, you know, they are all liberals. So the way I've been putting it is, I don't think you'll have a kind of, some of this stuff about, you know, Scholz and Macron and Mario Draghi in Rome kind of forming a new super trio at the heart of Europe, pushing this stuff forward, is possibly exaggerated. But I think that Scholz might be, where others align on this sort of stuff and where you're talking about incremental change, for example, possibly on the future of the Stability and Growth Pact, which of course is coming up for discussion next year as that is reapplied after the kind of the COVID slump. You know, it's an open secret that does need to be rewritten and rethought, particularly if you're going to make possible the sort of decarbonisation that the EU wants to drive under its slightly weirdly titled Fit for 55 kind of climate agenda. And you know, there it might be the case that, you know, if Macron and Draghi can line up, you know, a push to relax some of the strictures of the Stability and Growth Pact, Olaf Scholz would at least be open to that conversation in a way that perhaps Merkel wouldn't have been, at least not without the kind of the heat of a crisis. So that's a sort of long way of saying there might be a slight improvement in Germany's willingness to have these conversations, but probably nothing drastic.
Interesting, yeah. So put your champagne back on ice for the time being for supporters of major structural change in the Eurozone. That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms, but the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, I asked Jeremy what he made of the Labour Party conference and whether Germany offers lessons for the left internationally. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, you just need to sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anothereurope.org/join. It doesn't cost much at all and makes a big difference.